Hi, I'm Murray McLaughlin, and welcome to this edition of Swinging on a Star. This is the show about songs and the people who write them. My very special guest today, this is a bit of a unique show because we just have but the one guest, is Mr. Bruce Coburn. Backing us up today, we got Danny Greenspoon on the guitar and Mr. Tip Johnson on the bass. Stay tuned, I know you're going to enjoy it. When I recorded this first song I'm going to do originally, Bruce was kind enough to come into the studio and play guitar on it. So we thought we'd kind of revisit that, except I tried to goad him into singing on it too. It's a song that was inspired by the image of a great American clown. No, I'm not referring to George Bush. The clown's name was Emmett Kelly. And he was, to my knowledge, at least one of the first clowns that didn't, you know, he didn't look like a standard circus clown. He looked like more like an old hobo. You know, he didn't wear a red nose and yellow banana shoes and an orange fright wig and all that stuff. He looked like a bit like just an old ragamuffin hobo. He had white grease paint makeup on his mouth. That was his characteristic, and it made the corners of his mouth turn down. Well, he used to come out at the end of the show when the big top was finished, carrying an old fireplace broom made of straw. And the spotlight operator would throw a pool of light down in the sawdust of the big top ring, and Emmett would come out with his broom and try and sweep up this pool of light as though he was trying to clean up after the show. And of course, it would always get away from him. So I'm never one to let a metaphor go by. I wrote this.
1, 2, 3, and... Here's a plain, simple song, it ain't got much to say. Four times one plain circumstance finds me with someone whose world is all wrong, so they feel like they don't have a chance. It's alright to learn from the times you're a fool, but it don't pay to dwell on the past. Sometimes I think that I'm really a clown, but there's plenty of time left for that. Oh, the sun's gone down on the midway tonight, and the red stripes are turning to gray. But old Emmett's still out in the big top tonight, just a sweeping the spotlight away.
On the trash can lid, and the nights when there ain't much to do. Here's a song for the peace that it sometimes seems people always tell their troubles to. You might see a trace of a grease-paint face on everyone coming around. Don't you always laugh with a tear in your eye when you laugh at a sad-faced clown.
Yes, the sun's going down on the middle
some turning to gray. But old Emmett's still out in the big top tonight, just a sweeping the spotlight away. Somewhere there's a child that everyone hides, just a prisoner that longs to be free. Boys and girls in some fantasy world, but I could be just talking for me. But I feel him there behind me somewhere, when the streetlights reflect in the rain. The sad-faced clown with his mouth turned down, sweeping the spotlight away. Yes, the sun's gone down on the midway tonight, and the red stripes are turning to gray. But old Emmett's still out in the big top tonight, just a sweeping the spotlight away. Yes, the sun's going down on the midway tonight, and the red stripes are turning to gray. But old Emmett's still out in the big top tonight, just a sweeping the spotlight away.
Song.
I always liked it, you know. You ever get, I mean, you get a lot of tunes that are, you know, whatever works for you in terms of what paves the driveway, there's always ones that are kind of your personal favorites, and that's really a signature for me. It had lots of heart, or what passes for that in me anyway. I'm very, very happy to welcome my friend Bruce Coburn, for those of you who just tuned in to the Swinging on the Star. I think, without doing all the major commercials, he's certainly recognized as being one of the major influential forces in songwriting in Canada and throughout the world. And just before, you know, we start having to take a warm shower together or something like that. The first song you're going to do is on a subject, as I recollect, that's, well, it's very dear to my heart at this point, too, but it's an important subject, and it's very germane to the times.
Yeah, the situation of involving Native people throughout the Western Hemisphere is a situation that's too long been an unjust one and needs redress in a bad way. I came around to this song by a very long route in a way. Growing up, I don't know, it's probably true for most of us white folks in Canada, that, you know, if you grow up in an urban atmosphere, at least you don't get to see any Indians except on TV. And of course, when I finally actually met one, or two or three, all of a sudden those individuals assumed a human kind of status that the images that we were had thrown at us all the way through up growing up and so on never had, and that kind of brought the immediacy of their situation home in a way that no amount of reading about it ever could. But I also had been through a few years of being involved with Central America and other kinds of third world situations, and as I became aware of the details of the situation for most Native people here, it seemed to me to be very similar to, the issues were the same as those that we were dealing with respect to countries much further away and groups of people much further away. The song was written by Hugh Marsh and myself. I wrote the words and Hugh and I wrote the music. At the time that we wrote it, it had kind of a funk groove that's sort of Hubie's trademark. I've never really liked funk all that much. Anyway, I'm going to do the song by myself, and it's pretty hard to do funk by yourself anyway. So, and the black music that I relate to most is music that comes from a slightly earlier era. So There's more of that in this than there is of two live crew, you know. So anyway, this is a song. There's a couple of new songs, one of which we'll do later, that deal with the same kinds of issues. But this is the first of the songs that I wrote on Native themes, and it's called Stolen Land.
From Tierra del Fuego to Ungava Bay, the history of betrayal continues to today. The spirit of almighty voice, the ghost of anime, call like thunder from the mountains. You can hear them say it's a stolen land. In Arizona, slaughter in Brazil. If bullets don't get good PR, there's other ways to kill. Kidnap all the children, put them in a foreign system, bring them up in no man's land where no one really wants them. It's a stolen land. In black eye, sail as white as heroin, white like weathered bones, rum and guns and smallpox gonna change the face of home in this stolen land. Like me, you'd like to think we've learned from our mistakes, enough to know we can't play God with others' lives at stake. So now we've all discovered the world wasn't only made for whites. What step are you gonna take to try and set things right in this stolen land? Stolen land.
Let you swap guitars there for a minute. There's a, unlike, you know, I've always kind of thought of you as a person like outside of the normal behavior patterns associated with the music business as such.
Not to mention the rest of society.
Well, there is that sort of demonic Gemini quality about you, yeah. But you're, interestingly enough, you're one of the few writers I've ever encountered who isn't afraid to express anger in a song, or to to express a very strong point of view. And, you know, it's really an interesting juncture for this kind of stuff to be having, particularly stuff that's coming out of you. Just in respect to what's going on in general, being the greening of the world meets the worldwide native uprising at sort of the same time. So it's you seem to be responding to that on a very visceral level.
I started it. no false modesty here.
Do you think, like, native philosophy and religion dovetails nicely with your way of looking at the world?
To a degree, yeah, I would say so, in general. I mean, to the degree that I know native philosophy and religion, I'm sure there's a lot about it that I don't know. But there's nothing that's overtly incompatible anyway, you know, with my view, which is a sort of somewhat distorted Christian one, I guess. Probably distorted by contact with people like North American Indians.
But the song that that we're, you know, kind of going to do now was, I think, probably when I heard it, the first indication that I ever had, you know, when I listened to your music, that there was some religious force at work there. It sounded to me, when I heard the song, that you'd gone out and something, what's the word, like an epiphany, you know, something had happened, you'd crashed somewhere, and some insight had happened, or some major thing had happened to you that caused a change.
Well, in a way, it's not something that you can articulate, or at least that I can articulate very well in speech, but it was kind of a long, slow slide, if you want, uphill slide marked by a few little epiphanies of the sort that you're thinking of, little flashes, not quite like Paul in the desert getting swept off his horse and driven blind. Far from that, but important kinds of contact, I guess, is the best word I can think of to use. Contact with something larger, and larger than anything I'd contacted before, and essentially loving. And because I was coming at it from the background that I have, which is not a... I didn't grow up a Christian or anything. My parents are agnostics, but grew up in the cultural framework of Christianity, and therefore it seemed natural to relate to this contact through that framework. Mm-hmm. And therefore I'm a Christian. There are many ways in which I don't see eye to eye with a lot of other people who call themselves Christians, so, you know, I guess that's the way it works. But
so anyway, does this song All of Diamonds, is it, it sort of like fundamentally represents that kind of change?
Yeah, it's the first song that I wrote, and in a way marks the first song I wrote, comma, and in a way marks the change from a kind of non-specific interest in religious faith to thinking of myself as a Christian. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of one of those little internal events that marked that inspired the song, but that actually took place in Stockholm, which has nothing much to do with it except some of the imagery comes from boating around Stockholm, the Stockholm archipelago. Otherwise, the song is a celebration of the discovery of the reality of Christ. And it's called All the Diamonds in the World.
Diamonds in this world that mean anything to me are conjured up by wind and sunlight sparkling on the sea. Ground in a harbor town, lost a taste for being free. Thank God he sent some gold-chased ship to carry me flash bright and fade in reeds along the shore. Like a pearl in a sea, a liquid jade is shimmer comes shining like a crystal swan in a sky of suns. His ship comes shining.
You were making a reference earlier to your particular affection for black music being somewhat stronger for a more traditional brand. You know, like, you know, I guess Public Enemy might not necessarily be among your favorite acts.
Well, I don't have anything against them. I mean, I think well, other than a certain sexist bent, which I find offensive, but they've got some really neat stuff. A lot of the rap people do. It's just not really what I want to take home and put on the turntable that much.
Well, but, I think, you know, that you have drawn one major influence from the works of great blues artists. You know, like
the kind of down-home stuff that people like Public Enemy probably despise, like
I like to think of you as being full of surprises, and not the least of which is that you can write a song which, in the tradition of great black blues music, drips with sexual innuendo.
What a setup. This is, well, yeah, I'll let the song speak for itself. I'm not going to describe it at all, but you're right, the style in which it is written and hopefully performed, I don't know this one very well. You guys are guinea pigs for this. It's the first airing this song has ever had in public. It is in a style that's very much derived from the playing of people like Mississippi John Hurt, Mance Lipscomb, other black blues artists of the 40s, 30s. And I think I'm in tune enough to get away with it. They never tuned, but they got away with it better than I could. This is called Wake Up Willie.
Check your pipe. Wake up, Willie, got work to do. 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 She said, wake up, Willie. Look out the window, sun coming up. Look out the window, sun coming up. Need a little cappuccino in my loving cup. Wake up, Willie, got work to do. 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 She says, wake up, Willie.
A hot lick in there that it just kind of vanished for a minute.
Hey, wake up with it. Wake up there.
Yeah, it's really not quite there yet.
The traffic on the highway must be getting late. The traffic on the highway must be getting late. Get that oven, heat it up, and slap some breakfast on the plate. Says, wake up, Willie, got work to do. 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 She says, wake up, Willie. 7 p.m.
people sleepy-eyed over the ridge. Turn people sleepy-eyed over the ridge. Says, wake up, Willie, do some more of what you did. Wake up, Willie, got work to do. 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 She says, wake up, Willie.
Art there, Bruce.
Yeah, it's kind of Cubist blues.
Actually, that's a real, like, that was a real big pile of your early guitar playing influences. I mean, you had a collision war, major conflict between what they were trying to ram down your head at the Berklee School of Music and what you really liked, I guess. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I was heavily influenced by not just black music, but a lot of folk music. I kept in big band class, where we had to write Glenn Miller-style arrangements of stupid tunes. I was always pulling out Scottish folk songs and doing Glenn Miller-style arrangements of those, and I didn't get very good marks for them, but everybody got lots of laughs at my expense.
You're a big Django Reinhardt fan, too, weren't you?
Yeah, but I could never play like that, so I stopped listening to him because he was too depressing.
Didn't have the nerve to remove your fingers, I guess.
Yeah, and then maybe I would have been better. I don't know. But
is that why you wound up going to Paris, because you were a Django Reinhardt fan?
No, I wound up in Paris. That was a long... The first time I went to Paris was after I got out of high school. I spent a few months hitchhiking around Europe and fell in with some street musicians in Paris and... played six-string banjo, actually, which is probably the ugliest instrument ever invented. It's got somewhat the sound of a banjo, but it won't stay in tune no matter what you do with it, and every one of them I've ever encountered suffered from that. And you're supposed to be able to play it like a guitar, but when you try to play this kind of guitar on that kind of instrument, it comes out sounding less than perfect in the extreme. But it's loud, which means that when you're playing with a trumpet player and a clarinet player, you can be heard doing these awful things. And so that's what I was playing. I borrowed one of those.
So it was like a tin cup band. And
exactly, yeah, which did rather well, actually, until we got arrested. Because you needed a license in those days to sing on the street in Paris, and you had to be Parisian to get a license. And only one of the three of us was Parisian. And he didn't have a license. So we got arrested in Montmartre district and taken to the jail. But we did well, and it was fun. But that's sort of just about the last time I sang on the street, too.
Well, you've done an awful lot of drifting and rambling, and lately you've been doing a lot of it on the backs of large, four-footed, grass-eating things with evil gleams in their eyes. You've become quite a horseman, I understand.
Well, I don't know if I'm quite a horseman. I've been getting interested in riding the last few years, three or four years I've been riding.
People tell me when, you know, I've talked to people who've seen you ride, who've seen you actually go up to a jump and bravely go over it.
Yeah, well,
said it was
a bit
the most
of that.
Terrifying experience they've ever seen in their life.
Watching me nearly fly off
the
horse.
They wanted to call your insurance agent right away.
Yeah, well, I'm working on a set of bat wings for those occasions, you know, when the horse and I part company, I can sail.
Well, seriously, I mean, you've been going off and doing, like, mammoth trail rides and things like that?
Well, I spent a couple of weeks down in Arizona around Christmas time last year.
That's
doing
mammoth.
That kind of stuff. It was fun. It's really a lot of fun.
Well, this may sound like a clever segue, but the song that you were going to do actually sounds like it was written on the back of one.
Well, it wasn't exactly literally written on the back of one, but it did come, this is very clever indeed of you, it come from that trip to Arizona. The song was written near Tucson, out in the country, out in the desert. It's the first time I'd really ever been in a desert.
You talk while I bravely attempt to get one note out of this thing that will
I'd like to hear that that shriek that you heard.
God, I hope I can hit that note during the song. It's just a great note.
All right. This is called Child of the Wind. How did we start this one? I forget. I forget all our beginnings.
You go something like, 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3.
pounding of hooves. I love engines that roar. I love the wild music of waves on the shore. And the spiral perfection of a hawk when it soars. I love my sweet woman down to the core. There's roads and there's roads, and they call, can't you hear it? Roads of the earth and roads of the spirit. The best roads of all are the ones that aren't certain. One of those is where you'll find me till they drop the big curtain. In the bright diamond sky, these mountains are waiting, brown, green, and dry. I'm too old for the term, but I'll use it anyway. I'll be a child of the wind till the end of my day. Planet in a big universe. Sometimes it looks blessed, sometimes it looks cursed. Depends on what you look at, obviously. But even more, it depends on the way that you see. Mountains are waiting, brown, green, and dry. I'm too old for the term, but I'll use it anyway. I'll be a child of the wind till the end of my days. Hear the wind moan in the bright diamond sky. These mountains are waiting, brown, green, and dry. I'm too old for the term, but I'll use it anyway. I'll be a child of the wind till the end of my days.
Trouble is, the little devil doesn't want to do anything but play jigs and reels. Just wants
to, you
know, throw
a waltz at it,
and
goes mad.
This one's a nuclear attack on a old Western hero of American folklore.
Yeah, this actually arose from that same trip. I grew up, you know, watching. I was sort of on the tail end of the generation that was allowed to watch things that were known as serials. Only, you know, in my dad's day, like, they went to the theater and paid to go and see these things, and we went to the church basement on Saturday mornings. It was the sort of a church's attempt to outreach, I suppose, you know, show racist serials to little kids. And there was one of the figures that I remember very much from one of those serials was Kit Carson. There was one that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks about Kit Carson. You know what those serials are like. Once in a while they turn up on TV where every show ends with what was often literally a cliffhanger where, you know, I remember one where there's a herd of stampeding buffalo riding Kit Carson off the cliff, and at the end of the show he falls right off the cliff. The horse and all go tumbling right off this 300 or 400 foot cliff. And in the next show, they cut back, and he's riding toward the cliff, and he just gets away at the last possible second. You know, they just kind of change the whole plot. Anyway, that's serials. It happened. They all worked like that. But the important thing about this was that Kit Carson, of course, is known to us in through history as a great Western hero. Kit Carson, Indian fighter. You know, what Indian fighting actually meant, as it turns out, was riding at the head of a herd of cavalry, slaughtering everybody in sight, poisoning water holes, and burning everyone's houses. This is the Navajo Nation that was being treated in this particular fashion. There were other occasions like this too, I guess, involving Kit Carson, but this was the one that I became aware of. And it seemed like, I don't know, it just tweaked something, that there was a myth there that was an interesting counterpoint to the myth of Kit Carson, the hero, and that newer myth could be put in a kind of song, in the sort of song that would have been written about the old myth, you know, if that makes any sense at all. It won't as soon as you hear the song. Or maybe it will. I'm supposed to play this on the electric, but if it's not going to throw too big a curve at you guys, I think I'll do it on the acoustic anyway, okay? Since I've got it on. So this is called, in fact, Kit Carson.
To Kit Carson, take my best four horsemen, please, and ride out to the four directions, make my great lands barren for me, make my great lands barren for me. Kit Carson said to the president, you've made your offer sweet, I'll accept this task you've set for me. My fall's not yet complete. My fall's not yet complete. Job to do, like other jobs he'd done before. He made the grade, he'd learned to trade in famine, pestilence, and war. Famine, pestilence, and war. Kit Carson was a hero to some, with his poison and his flame. But somewhere there's a restless ghost that used to bear his name. That used to bear his name.
We all ended at once. All right.
That's great. My first trip to Japan, my only trip to Japan so far, actually, come to think of it, I'll never wind up, was with you.
It's true.
What happened? I just have these memories of Hiroshi Asada being a total lunatic, of Bernie eating more food than I've ever seen a human being eat, and having Japanese guys smash into his stomach with their heads, screaming sumo and laughing like hyenas and falling on their backs in alleys. I remember playing As Time Goes By on a piano in this little bar called As Time Goes By in Kanazawa, and then we drank for free for the whole night, and then I don't remember anything else.
Yeah.
Except for Hiroshi singing in his real thick Japanese accent, singing the Ballad of Ira Hayes, which I thought was about the weirdest thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah, actually, he was a pretty good. I think he aspired to be a country and western singer, right?
Yeah, he was a major country and western fan.
He was the promoter of our tour, for those who are not familiar with his name.
The household word, Hiroshi Asada.
Yeah, I ran into him in L.A. a couple of years ago.
Did you?
Yeah, he showed up at a place I was playing.
How old is Tom, his son? He must be like about, 26 now or something.
No. Actually, he might be,
Yeah, he was
four
then.
I don't want to think any further about this right now.
Well, that trip had a profound effect on me. It shook me right out of my little North American niche in a big hurry. And obviously, it must have had the same effect on you.
Certainly,
you've never been the same since. I knew you before and after. You came back really weird.
It was the... I see. It was certainly the beginning of that aspect of my education, too. The first time I'd been anywhere outside of North America, except for that early trip to Europe. Changed my perspective on a lot of things, or started to, anyway. There were a lot of other trips that contributed more to it, perhaps, but that was the beginning. That first trip, I don't think I got... Did I get a song out of that first trip? I think maybe, yeah, Nanzenji.
Yeah, I think...
A very obscure song on an album that no one bought. But it's kind of pretty. It's got a dog barking at the end of it, too, which is very zen. But the second trip did produce a song and a half. Anyway, that second tour was every bit as interesting and exciting as the first one, and every bit as tiring. One of the interesting things about being in a place like Japan is you can't, unless you're fluent in Japanese, of course, you can't get around by yourself because you can't even read a street sign. You can't tell what goods are sold in what storefronts or anything like that, except for the storefront plastic surgery hospitals. And the which have pictures in the window, like barbershops do here. And the
wait a minute, you mean like a selection of noses or something? I've never seen.
Yeah,
that.
Noses. And at that time, I think it's gone out of favor now. But at that time, there was the first time we went. Actually, there was an operation that was popular at the time, which was to get a section of your colon removed, which would make your skin lighter.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. That's worse than witchetty grubs. That's your worst story yet.
It's pretty disgusting, isn't it? But I read that in Time magazine, actually. And we know that everything that Time magazine says is true. Anyway, that was apparently popular, and these storefront surgeries seem to bear that out. But and restaurants, of course, which have the plastic food that sometimes you see in the restaurants here as well, the Japanese restaurants, little rubber shrimp and things like that in the window, so you could tell what they serve.
I've always wanted to build a plastic replica of myself to go and have dinner.
I'd like to see that. But the interesting thing about that all is that you're totally dependent on the people around you. You can't get around at all by yourself. So there's a certain openness I found that goes with that dependency. You just become a little bit sensitized to people. And especially in Japan, where there's so much concern, although perhaps I might have exaggerated the importance of this, but about manners and the proper social way in which everything is done. Anyway, I found myself in a certain sensitized state, and the last day I was there, on the way to the airport, with some people who were taking me around, we're driving on a freeway that was several levels high, and on one on the lanes going the opposite way, which were separated from our side of the road by a huge chasm of freeway that had a river in the bottom of it, or a kind of canal, a car had just gone off the other set of lanes into this body of water, and they hadn't even got cranes there yet to pull it up. There was a police car on the scene, and the traffic was stopped, but that's all. The guardrail was out, and there was somebody drowning down in that river right then. And I found that, in that state especially, to be particularly shocking, and it kind of threw everything else that happened on that trip, which was basically very positive, into a very sharp relief. And I guess then I got on the plane and had lots of time to think about it while I was sitting next to the Japanese representative to the World Bank on the airplane. And in between talking about world banking, which led to part of another song called How I Spent My Fall Vacation, I was thinking about these images and so on of the trip, and what came out was the song Tokyo.
One, two,
One, two, three, four. To haul a car out of the river. Noise and smoke and concrete seem to be going on forever. Grinding gears and drivers getting high on exhaust. I'm thinking about the water down below and what got lost.
The jingle jingle in space, torpedo beams, comic book violence and escaping steam. Gray-suited businessmen pissing against the wall. Cut to crumbling guardrail, slow-motion car fall.
Oh, Tokyo, I never can sleep in your arms.
Mine keeps on ringing like a fire alarm. Me and all these other dice bouncing around in the cup. You have to show me that accident scene. It might get enough shaking up. Still I'm gonna miss you.
Good fortune struggles with the trickster fox. Energy and patience and the power of the buck. Tonight I'm flying headlong to meet the dark red edge of dawn. I know somebody will be crying and somebody will be gone. Oh, Tokyo, I never can sleep in your arms.
Mine keeps on ringing like a fire alarm.
Dice bouncing around in the cup. Would you have to show me that accident scene? Didn't I get enough shaking up? Still I'm gonna miss you.
Murray McLaughlin. One of us is Willie Nelson and one of us is Julio Iglesias. Which is which?
Well, that wraps up today's edition of Swinging on a Star. And a million thanks to my guest, Bruce Coburn. Many, many thanks to Danny Greenspoon on the guitar and Mr. Kip Johnson on the bass. Join me next week when my guests will be Margo and Michael Timmons of the Cowboy Junkies and John Bottomley. I'm Murray McLaughlin, and we'll see you next week for Swinging on a Star.